Good afternoon and welcome. My name is David Thoreau and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum today. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding experts to address major social and economic issues, especially as they may relate to important new books. And today is no exception. For those of you new to the Institute, you've no doubt found the packet on our program at your seat. The Independent Institute is a nonprofit, non-politicized scholarly research and educational organization located here in the Bay Area. The Institute regularly sponsors in-depth studies on major social and economic issues. Our program adheres to the highest standards of independent inquiry, and the resulting studies are widely distributed as books and other publications, and are publicly debated through numerous conference and media programs. Our purpose is a Jeffersonian one of seeking truth to the extent humanly possible regarding the impact of various government policies, and not necessarily just to tell people what they might want to hear. In so doing, we will not take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value, nor the conventional wisdom necessarily over serious public issues. Hence, we invite your involvement, but be prepared for new and challenging perspectives. The Institute neither accepts nor seeks government funding, but instead draws its support from a diverse range of foundation, business, and individual support. We invite you all to become tax-deductible members of the Institute. In your packet, you'll find information on the benefits that members can receive as far as receiving copies of books and other publications, as well as discounts to programs like this. Our program today could not be more timely. In making this Independent Policy Forum today possible, I want to especially thank the members of our host committee that you'll see listed on the program in your packet, as well as David Packard, for their kind assistance and support. As we all know, with Californians' current economic despair, we're all concerned, and rightfully so, over what can be done to get us out of this current rut. More than any other nation, America has benefited from entrepreneurial freedom. But whereas in the 1980s, the Forbes 400 of the so-called wealthiest people in the United States experienced its biggest turnover ever, going into the 1990s, our growth and prosperity, we believe, in California and elsewhere, seems to have stalled. We are truly delighted to be sponsoring our program today for numerous reasons. For 15 years, perhaps more than anyone, George Gilder has demonstrated in his many best-selling books and widely read articles how we can recapture the spirit of enterprise so essential to human betterment. His book, Wealth and Poverty, created a worldwide sensation, showing how the public good of both economic development and social welfare can only be advanced through the social cooperation and individual dynamics of free market capitalism. The book laid the intellectual foundation for the entrepreneurial revolution of the early to mid-1980s, as tax rates were cut and individual enterprise was unleashed, unlike it was in previous years. His subsequent book, The Spirit of Enterprise, shows what entrepreneurship means and its indispensability to human progress. Throughout most of human history, men and women have suffered under the bureaucratic yoke of statism in a seemingly endless variety of forms. As the late Nobel laureate economist F.A. Hayek so cogently described in his brilliant book, The Fatal Conceit, each such system falls prey to the fatal conceit of believing now they, some group, through some committee, board, communard, health alliance, or what have you, can ignore the laws of economics and somehow reinvent society, willy-nilly, according to their own schemes, and then impose this new order on the so-called less enlightened masses. To the elite powers of each regime, the populace has been viewed as mere fodder for its own gain, both in war or peace. The masses could not be allowed to make their own choices. And what's more, such freedom was far too dangerous to the elites, for if individual citizens understood that they could advance their own existence on their own, who then would need or tolerate the rulers themselves? Instead of being chained to a recurring series of tyranny, mankind has had a way out, a society not based on state-imposed privilege or dictates, but one based on individual choice, voluntary action, and the mutual contracts of consenting parties. It is this system that revolutionized the world, unleashing the natural indigenous market forces of any society, and bringing the populace out of what seemingly was a caste of desperate poverty and disease for millennia. Today, we're witnessing an accelerated worldwide revolution in entrepreneurship, even we hope here in California, despite the best efforts of many local, state, and federal officials. Markets are expanding nearly everywhere globally, and the tyrannies of the past are, generally speaking, being forced to retreat. I'm happy to say that both of George's books, Wealth and Poverty and the Spirit of Enterprise, now entitled Recapturing the Spirit of Enterprise, are available in brand new revised editions from our good friends at ICS Press, and we have copies for you here. A senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, George Gilder is, as many of you know, editor of ASAP, the quarterly high technology supplement of Forbes magazine. He's also a member of the board of advisors of the Independent Institute. He's a graduate of Harvard University. He's been a fellow of the Kennedy Institute of Politics, chairman of Lehrman Institute's Economic Roundtable, and program director at the Manhattan Institute. In addition to his forthcoming book, Telecosm, George is also the author of Life After Television, Visible Man, Men and Marriage, and The Party That Lost Its Head, with his co-author Bruce Chapman. In addition, he is a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, National Review, and many other leading publications. So I'm very pleased to introduce him to speak on the subject of recapturing the spirit of enterprise, after which he'll be happy to field questions and perhaps even autograph a few books for us. So let me introduce George Gilder.
Thank you very much, David. I spent a lot of the morning defending the spirit of enterprise on the Michael Krasny show, is it? It's something you have here on PBS in San Francisco. And I came to realize just how relevant this book is. I mean, it was completely rewritten a couple years ago and four new chapters were added to it, and all the stories and previous essays in it were updated. So it really is a new book. But answering the questions coming over the telephone lines to the Krasny show, I realized that the audience of PBS has been living in a different world for the last decade or so. It's a world of poverty and decline and decay, and beset everywhere with problems that are promoted by government into crises, which then have to be solved by new programs. Now, my great theme for the last decade or so, which I have adopted from Peter Drucker, one of the great men of our era, is don't solve problems, pursue opportunities. Now, I just came from Washington, flew into Seattle, and I won't give you my itinerary. I can't keep up with it. But But in Washington really is the problem center. And they trump up problems into crises and then launch solutions, which collectively represent the one great problematic of the modern era. That is the steady expansion of government, which itself is the fundamental problem, but which they can't solve in Washington. You know, we've had a health crisis, a poverty crisis, an inequality crisis, a trade crisis. Oh yeah, a trade crisis. Clinton's really tough on trade, isn't he? Tanya Harding strategy for competitiveness. It's all his advisors have been maintaining for the last 10 years or so that the Japanese would just blow us away in a whole series of areas. Remember the semiconductor crisis. We weren't going to have any semiconductor industry in a few years unless the government intervened and launched some massive effort in favor of semiconductor competitiveness. And at the time I said that entrepreneurs were solving this alleged problem at the very time they announced it, and that shortly the U.S. would regain dominance in semiconductors. This I said in 1985-86 when it appeared that the Japanese were surging ahead. And sure enough, this year the United States, including all our production, is about 10% ahead of the Japanese in semiconductors, in microchips. And we're massively ahead in computers, and we're massively ahead in the essential dimensions of telecommunications. The U.S. has, during all these years, when crises were being announced every year, the U.S. was pulling decisively ahead in the very most critical areas of the information economy, which really will assure dominance for the decades to come, and have had the slightly unfortunate impact of giving the Clinton administration an opportunity to exercise its cock-a-doodle-doo theory of American competitiveness. You know, the cock-a-doodle-doo theory, you announce that you're going to support all these sunrise industries, and sure enough, the sun does rise, and Al Gore trots over to some fence post and declares cock-a-doodle-doo, and claims credit for it all. And this is the essential strategy that I hope the Clinton administration will pursue, because as long as they do restrict themselves to the Chanticleer role, they won't inflict the kind of profound damage on entrepreneurs which they would aspire to inflict. So all these problems in Washington really are spurious, mostly, except for the one problem, which is Washington itself. And I think that's even true about some of the conservative problems that we cite. I mean, the deficit has actually so bemused a lot of conservative groups that they actually give the impression that the Reagan administration was a time of runaway debt rather than a miraculous period of huge and unprecedented asset creation. That's what happened during the Reagan administration. In 1979, we had virtually a budget in balance, and we had virtually no trade gap in 1979. But the whole private economy was wallowing in red ink, and most state governments were deep in debt, and state and local and private pension funds were hundreds of billions of dollars in the red in 1979. And during the Reagan administration, there is about a $6 to $7 trillion creation of new assets in all these areas, and in pension funds, and in state and local governments, including California was a great beneficiary. And the fact is that the debt-asset ratios of American business massively improved throughout the 1980s. And the key industries of today, the key companies you read about day after day in the newspapers, were largely financed by the most widely condemned and lamented of all the debt instruments that were introduced during the 1980s, namely the junk bond. You know, TCI, McCaw, Time Warner, Viacom, MCI, all these companies, which are the very foundations of the information economy on which we're embarked for the next decade, the foundations for the information superhighway that for which Al Gore will play the rooster, we're all financed by junk bonds, and not just a little few junk bonds. I mean, MCI got $2 billion from Milken when it was a $200 million company, and its goal was to install fiber optic long distance system, the first fiber optic long distance system, at a time when AT&T was projecting fiber optics for long distance sometime deep in the 21st century. And $2 billion of junk bonds financed one entrepreneur financing another entrepreneur, William McGowan, Milken financing McGowan, launched the fiber optic era. And cable TV has become a major U.S. asset. We are the only country in the world that has broadband connections to 60% of its homes. Broadband connections are capable of a full gigahertz, billion hertz of communications. It's some 70,000 times more capacious, these coaxial connections, than the phone company links to homes. And this unique American asset, again, was financed by billions and billions of dollars of junk bonds, $2 billion for TCI alone, Viacom about $1 billion, Time Warner, which at the time was was Warner and was in desperate straits as a result of the Atari collapse, got $1 billion. That just all these major companies, and McCaw, which is the key to the U.S. leadership in cellular telephony, which is another major opportunity for the 1990s. McCaw got $2 billion at a critical moment that allowed McCaw to enter cellular telephony. These companies, financed by Milken, are collectively worth $80 billion today, just these ones I mentioned. And they were widely depicted as a Ponzi scheme and many assaults on the greed of the 1980s. So I think that the entrepreneurial upsurge of the 1980s is the key asset for the American economy in the 1990s. And to the extent that it can continue and we don't fall into the trap of policy that I depict in Wealth and Poverty, and really Recapturing the Spirit of Enterprise has a chapter called Capitalism Without Capitalists. And that's really the kind of capitalism that the administration wants. It pretends to support capitalism, but it's capitalists that it can't stand. This was actually Tsongas in the last campaign said the trouble with Democrats is that they love employment. It's employers they can't stand. And that really was the perfect insight, because the foundation of economic growth is entrepreneurship. And this book that Vedder and Galloway have written and been published by Independence Institute called Out of Work is directly on target. It shows that throughout all American history, the key force in creating unemployment has been government. And if you think Vedder and Galloway's arguments are perhaps hypothetical or lacking proof, you just have to look to Europe today. In Europe, after decades, when in every political campaign the major issue was jobs, you go over there, jobs, preserving jobs, creating jobs has been the refrain in every European political campaign for about the last 40 years. And after 40 years of preserving and creating jobs, the Europeans today have unemployment rates that resemble the U.S. during the midst of the Great Depression. The Europeans have long-term unemployment today. That's unemployment for longer than 6 months, six times higher than U.S. unemployment rates. And the Europeans have levels of overall employment that's decidedly lower than the United States. And this is the result of government solving problems. They've been solving the unemployment problem in Europe for 30 years, and the result is an unemployment disaster, a real crisis, incidentally, which again derives from this overall problem of excessive government. Well, today we, I said, don't solve problems, pursue opportunities. And I think we do face an unprecedented opportunity, which is uniquely favorable to the cause of human liberty. And that opportunity comes from these very technologies which entrepreneurs have launched and developed over the last decades. They come from technologies of sand and glass and air. Really, remember in the late 1970s, everybody was talking about an energy crisis, a natural resource crisis. Well, these technologies are based on the most common substances in the crust of the Earth. Literally, the microchip is made of silicon, aluminum, and oxygen, which are the three most common substances in the Earth's crust. And they are the foundation of the microchip revolution. And on the radio this morning, everybody wanted to tell me about the environment. Well, these new technologies are mostly subsist on the human mind. And they, as they spread, they almost inherently overcome all the environmental crises that are alleged by these opponents of economic growth that go by the name of the environmental movement. So we begin with this technology of sand. A silicon sliver the size of your thumbnail, inscribed with a logical pattern as complex as a street map of America, switching its traffic in trillions of seconds. Today, it's possible to put about 20 million transistors on a single sliver of silicon and produce it in volume. But within 10 years, or less than 10 years, around the turn of the century, it's going to be possible to put a billion transistors on a single sliver of silicon. That's a billion transistors. A billion transistors is equivalent to the central processing units of 16 Cray YMP supercomputers. A Cray supercomputer costs about $20 million. 16 of them would be $320 million. That kind of computing power, 16 Crays, will be manufacturable on a single silicon sliver for under $100 shortly after the turn of the century. This is the most important fact in the world economy today. It's the silicon juggernaut, which is just going to sweep away all the information industries that resist it. Remember the Japanese threat of HDTV? This was an analog HDTV system that the Japanese adopted. when it was introduced a few years ago, I said, HDTV's a dog. It's never going to fly. It's sure to fail because of this tremendous rise in the power of digital electronics. Computers will blow away TV of all kinds. And the only reason people are even interested in HDTV, I said, was that it's a dog, and the politician is always the dog's best friend. And that was true then for the same reason that this entrepreneurial onrush of creativity in semiconductors and computers would just blow it away, and that is happening. But still, the semiconductor itself just provides for separate computers, and it's great. It gives one person at a workstation the creative power of an industrial tycoon of the previous era, but still, it's separate people at workstations. I think of the image of the car in the jungle. If you encountered a car in the jungle, even if you'd never seen a car before, you might find it quite a dazzling technology. Here it has radio, heater, air conditioning, even a loud horn to frighten away fierce animals, bedding, all kinds of stuff. It's a great technology. And encountering this technology, and you might never imagine that the real magic of automobiles comes in conjunction with roads. And it's similarly with computers. For 20 years or so, we used our computers chiefly as cars in the jungle. We used them separately to do word processing and a few other functions, spreadsheets. But we never really understood that the true power of computers, the true computer revolution, only comes when computers are joined together in networks. And that is what's happening today, and that is what produces the real juggernaut of sand and glass and air. Because when the computer technology of sand joins with the fiber optic technology of glass and the technologies of the radio frequency spectrum of air, that's when you really have the magic of computer technology coming to the fore. And that's just happening today. Between 1989 and 1993, the share of computers in the United States connected to networks rose from under 10% to over 60%. That's just in 4 years. And as these information highways come into line, this is going to endow the computer with new exponential powers, just as the law of the microcosm derives from the proposition that you put any number n transistors on a single sliver of silicon, and you get n squared performance. You get exponential performance measured by the power delay product in semiconductor manufacturing. So, and that's really been the heart of this semiconductor revolution, why it has distributed power around the world, because you get this exponential improvement as you increase the number of semiconductors on a single device. Well, the law of the telecosm is you take any number of computers and you interconnect them on computer networks, and you get any number n computers, and you get n squared performance and value. In other words, the value of computers rises exponentially as you interconnect them in networks. And that is going to be the driving force of the world economy for the next decade. Just as the plummeting price of transistors has driven the world economy for the last decade. So the hugely increasing value of computers and the plummeting price of bandwidth, that is, to connect computers, will drive the world economy for the next decade. And Adam Smith maintained that the creative power of capitalism derives from the division of labor, you know, the increase in specialization which drives and expands the market. Well, this is what computer networks are. They're engines of the division of labor. They make it possible for the best people in the world to solve a particular problem, to gather together to solve it, regardless of the constraints of geography. And this spread of computer networks will spur a huge expansion of economic growth around the world. And once again, all these achievements came despite the collapse of all the major big companies in the computer industry. During the 1980s, all the major big American computer companies either collapsed or finally declined. And what drove this marketplace was the emergence of scores of thousands of new computer and computer software companies. It's this entrepreneurial insurgence that made it possible. To people on the radio this morning, we're all convinced that this was really only a revel of greed. But I think that, and they constantly referred to the homeless as sort of a typical harvest of capitalism. And, you know, it is a real question. It's a real enigma of capitalism, the reasons for its distribution of wealth that it creates. I mean, why does Harry Helmsley have $1 billion while Harry Homeless sits in a rug in a grate? And all my interlocutors this morning were assured that it was because Harry Helmsley was so greedy, that it was the greed of the capitalist that caused the poverty of the homeless. And that, in other words, the fundamental belief that wealth causes poverty. That's really what you can sum up the theory of the left, you know, the belief that wealth essentially comes from stealing. You know, this is a very popular position, both at in prisons, where I've interviewed, and at Harvard. They believe that wealth essentially comes from stealing. And intellectuals want to believe that because it disparages the competitive intellectual class of entrepreneurs. And the people in prison want to believe that because it extenuates their own crimes. But true greed, what greed really is, the desire for unearned benefits. And Harry Homeless occupies some of the most valuable real estate on the face of the earth, from the beaches of Santa Monica to the center of Manhattan. And Harry wants to live better than most of the people throughout the history of the world without giving anything whatsoever back to his society. And that's the very epitome of greed. What the entrepreneur does is constantly give back to his society. That's his fundamental principle. His companies survive and prosper to the extent that they respond imaginatively to the needs of others. That's how an entrepreneur prospers. Greed leads, as by an invisible hand, to an ever-growing welfare state, because the greedy person The best way that he can assure unearned benefits is to turn to government and have government steal from others to gratify his greed. Greed leads as by an invisible hand to an ever-growing welfare state, to socialism. The entrepreneur really has to be altruistic in his orientation. The entrepreneur has to understand the needs of others. He has to forego his own appetites to save. That's foregoing consumption. That's what saving is. He has to collaborate with other people. He has to reinvest. And investment is another term for giving. And when you invest, you give to others. You give your resources to others, and you trust them to preserve or increase their value. Giving is difficult. The chief fallacy of socialism is the idea that giving is easy. You just take it from one person and give it to the other and benefit the community. But if all of us know that it is very hard to give without hurting. We encounter this problem all the time with our children, and we encounter it on Christmas season. It's hard to give. It's hard. It takes understanding of others to give successfully. And the true foundation of capitalist success is that it is productive giving. An investment is a truly productive gift. It truly responds to the needs of others and truly helps others. And that is really the heart of capitalist success. So, and it's also the key rule of entrepreneurship, is entrepreneurs don't get rich by taking, they get rich by giving. And if they're chiefly interested in their own consumption, that's the surest sell sign in any company. If you have a CEO who's chiefly interested in advancing his own consumption, you better sell. And it's property rights that link the giving of enterprise to the rise of the capitalist economy. So the key principle of economic policy is to assure that the same people who create wealth also invest it, because the best conceivable education for the further creation of wealth is the demonstration of past creation of wealth. The entrepreneurial experience allows the entrepreneur to invest effectively, because it joins the two principal yields of enterprise. One yield is a financial profit, and the other yield is a profit of learning, of knowledge. And a capitalist economy is a knowledge system. And the reason it prevails is because the same people who create wealth also reinvest it. So the knowledge profit is joined with the financial profit, and that generates new wealth and opportunity for everyone. And it's this foundation of capitalism in the moral order through giving, and in the information economy through the convergence of knowledge and power in enterprise that explains the triumph of countries that pursue the spirit of enterprise. Thank you very much, and I'd be delighted to...